Well, today we're talking about supernatural wisdom. And really the theme here is three wisdoms. The first wisdom we talked about yesterday, or I spoke about yesterday, in terms of philosophical wisdom that rises up to metaphysics as, in a way, the highest and most powerful, deepest consideration of what is by the light of natural reason. So I wanted to just start off by saying I hope that it was evident why it's important to talk about this. It's not just because we're interested in clarifying what Aquinas means by metaphysics or something like that, but rather that, and I hope it was also clear as we did some of the, real philosophizing in the Q&A yesterday, that when you move to the highest philosophical and metaphysical considerations, you're moving into a zone that has a great deal of power for understanding, and that even though we're dealing with abstractions, nonetheless can be very rich in intelligibility and in meaning. So when you talk about what is goodness and what is evil, or what is perfection, what is a cause, or perhaps how all things besides God are some composition of essence and existence, or of act and potency. In other words, when you're talking about what is, or distinguishing what is and that it is, you begin to see that these kinds of considerations are foundational for every discipline, because they pertain to the consideration of being as being. And so they have a kind of universality, and if you want to understand the whole from the highest possible perspective, if you want to understand the causes of things and the reason for things, and be able to understand how all things in some way are related and have this kind of, there's a hierarchy of being, then you need to be thinking in this realm. And then that helps us understand how the various things that we do in the university are related to one another, and how there can be a kind of hierarchy of disciplines or of sciences. And it also is helpful to understand what we are trying to do as intellectuals and where we will find the most ultimate answers. But in addition to this, what I'd like to underline, which is the theme of our sessions together, how the mind is then able to rise up through various sciences and various ways of considering reality under different aspects, different formal aspects, so that ultimately we're able to contemplate the highest things available to the gaze of reason. We seek to know the first and ultimate sources, the first and ultimate cause. But in fact, there is something even higher than this. And that's now what I'd like to talk about. That is a way of knowing reality. In fact, a way of knowing the most ultimate reality, which is God, that transcends the power of our reason itself. And that God actually wants to share this with us. And this gives a higher wisdom. But before going straight to that higher wisdom, I'd like to just round out our discussion from yesterday by speaking a little bit about the ways Aquinas thinks we can know God even by our natural reason, even with our minds unaided by the light of grace. So he says constantly that we need a kind of humility when we stand before the mystery of God. God is infinitely above us, such that, and this is kind of a tagline that Aquinas would repeat many times over, we cannot know what God is, but only what he is not in this life. But even that statement does not cause Aquinas to give up on seeking to know God. We want to confess that we know God, even by natural reason, but we know him in a certain way as unknown. Okay, that's mysterious, so let's talk about that. Aquinas actually thinks that there are three ways for us to come to know something about God, even by natural reason, even with the work of our minds unaided by the light of grace, and that we can arrive at some real knowledge of God. These three ways that God can be known in this life by the way of reason, he calls the way of causality. So, based on our natural knowledge, it's impossible for us to know God directly, to see him directly, but we can see the effects of God in the world. And from seeing those effects, we are able to reason to the existence of their cause. So it's a bit, the claim is a bit like, you might draw an analogy to, say, our eyes and infrared light. The natural power of our eye is simply incapable of seeing infrared light. But there are other things that we can do that will lead us to infer that infrared light is real, even though our eyes cannot detect it, in a way. And Dr. Fazer talked a lot about this in his proof for the existence of God yesterday. It's really working through in a rigorous way that rising of the mind to God by way of causality. So we can prove that God exists because of the effects of God in the world. Okay, the second way is called the way of immanence. Any affirmation about God that we make is, in the way it exists in God, infinitely above what we understand. So, for example, we can say a phrase like, God is good, and this is true. And we want to say that God is good not just because he causes good things in the world, but rather that he is the cause of goodness because he is good. He is good infinitely, perfectly, essentially. Now, I'm not going to spend much time talking about that, but this is another classical way of coming to know something about God. The way that we take some created perfection, and then we attribute it to God, but we recognize that in attributing it to God, it exists in a higher way in God than our minds can understand. And there's a lot to be said there about the doctrine of analogy, which Dr. Fazer referred to yesterday, which I'm not going to go into. There's plenty of interesting things, but just in the interest of moving forward and getting to the supernatural wisdoms that we really want to be talking about. The third way is could be called the negative way or the negative path. In Latin, it's the via remotionis, Aquinas will say, the way of removal or the way of separation. And this, there are a couple texts that I've given you on the handout where Aquinas talks about this. Look at the first one. This is from one of Aquinas' sermons, something that people don't often refer to, especially when you're working in philosophy, but it's actually really interesting. He says in this sermon, on the Feast of the Holy Trinity, so he's talking, actually he's talking about the seraphim who cry out with a threefold cry, holy, holy, holy. So he's trying to explain what that means when we're talking about God. He says, no path is as fruitful for coming to know God as that which proceeds by separation, by removal. For then God is perfectly known when we know that he is above everything that can be thought of. Hence we read about Moses, who is very familiar with God, according to what is granted to a human being in this life, that he approached God in a cloud and a thick mist, meaning by getting to know what God is not, he arrived at a knowledge of God. This way of separation is what we understand in the word holy, because it is generally taught that holy is what is pure, and what is pure is what is separated from others. Okay, that's Aquinas speaking to a kind of lay audience, and using scriptural texts that they would be familiar with and interested in hearing. But then we can look at a more rigorously philosophical text where he explains in a little more detail precisely what this negative path is like. This is from the Summa Contra Gentiles, Book 1, Chapter 14. It's the second text there. In the study of the divine substance, the negative path is required above all else. The divine substance surpasses in its immensity all the forms that our intellect reaches. And thus, we cannot grasp it by knowing what it is, quid est. We can, however, get a kind of knowledge about it. And the phrase there actually is aliquam notitiam, a certain... So notitia in Latin isn't yet the full sense of knowledge, which would in Latin be scientia. Scientia is like a certain knowledge. Notitia means like we get notice of it. We get some kind of information about it. So he's not claiming that we comprehend it in itself. He's claiming that we get some kind of important information about it in this way. We can get a kind of knowledge, aliqualem notitiam, by coming to know what it is not, quid non est. And we will draw nearer to that knowledge as through our understanding we can discard more things from him. That's actually interesting. What he's saying is, in our minds, in the understanding of your mind, you need to begin to remove things from your idea of God. Remove things that are not sufficiently pure about him. So this is involving a kind of purification of our minds. Now, that's actually very profound, and there are real spiritual insights here, too. When a few months ago, the terrible news about the clerical scandals and the McCarrick scandal and such were coming out, it just so happened that I had started reading Dionysius's Divine Names commentary. And it was like a wonderful salve for my mind to try and raise my mind to the purity of God in the midst of these very tawdry claims about an important minister of the church, which is so deeply discouraging and heartbreaking and disedifying and ugly, awful, right? And if we dwell on those things, of course, we get depressed, and we are, you know, we're saddened, and we're revolted, and we're angry, and all of that. But actually, it is nonetheless possible in the midst of that to raise your mind up, and actually, as you raise your mind up to the things of God, there is a kind of purification of the mind that is happening, where lower things are seen as relative in comparison with the true perfection that you find in God. And this is, in a more rigorous way, the kind of thing that Aquinas wants to do with our concepts about God. We have to purify them so that they would become capable of attaining in some way, to give us some aliquam notitiam, right? Some knowledge, a certain kind of knowledge of God himself. So at the risk of making too trivial a comparison, think of a kind of game that maybe you would play at a party or maybe a family gathering or something like that, pretty tame as a party game, where you try to guess what your partner is thinking, right? And how would you do this? You do it by asking questions, and probably the simplest way, the fastest way to get to the answer is by using the process of elimination. You're going to ask... is it a thing or is it alive? Is it a plant or is it an animal? And you're looking for no, because that actually is going to exclude, you know, is it a plant? No. Okay, now I've gained an important piece of information about what it is because I've excluded a whole class of things that it is not. Is it a person? No. Okay, so you're making advances. That's the kind of thing Aquinas wants us to do in a much more elevated way with God, that we're able to remove from our consideration all the things that bespeak change, limitation, potency, materiality, time, timeliness, like being in time. All of those things have to be removed as our concepts are purified so that they actually can express the perfection of God. Okay, so let's go back to the text. For we know each thing more perfectly, the more fully we see its differences from other things. For each thing has within itself its own being, distinct from all other things. So too, in the case of things whose definitions we know, we locate them in a genus, through which we know in a general way what they are. So think of, like, the genus of animal, right? We can use the genus of animal, and we know in general what an animal is. Then we add differences to each thing, by which it may be distinguished from other things. In this way, a complete knowledge of a substance is built up. Okay, so think about, like, you have animal, and then you add a specific difference. What's a famous specific difference to add to animal to get a species?
Number of legs.
Okay, number of legs, that would be actually something that Aquinas would say is not a good specific difference, actually. He uses that specific example as, don't use that specific difference. He thinks there's a more fundamental specific difference between animals. Now, don't just think of animals the way in the most common, maybe American English sense of the term. Philosophically speaking, what's a specific difference that you could add to animal?
Rational,
right. So you have rational animals and irrational animals. We are rational animals, right? Okay, so you've added something that really does divide the species. That, by way of footnote, if you want to have, like, interesting conversations tonight or tomorrow night at our, you know, at dinner or at the reception afterwards, you know, you could ask, well, if there's a embodied space alien who has, like, a very different body than us, you know, it looks like some kind of, I don't know, a squid or something, but it's rational. Is that a man? And some Thomists would want to say, yes, it's a rational animal. Like, that's actually what we are. So it would not satisfy the biologist who wants to ask, like, can you mate with it? Right? That's contemporary biology. But in fact, it's a rational animal. And so, like, I know other Dominicans who would say, if there are space aliens that look like a squid and they're rational, they're human, and Christ has redeemed them. I'm not going there. But you can discuss that later. Okay, so what have we done? In this example, you have a genus, animal, and we've added a specific difference, rational, that has allowed us to narrow down and come to know what it is. What is a human being, or what is a man? It's a rational animal. That's the species. And now notice what we've done there, that when we've added this specific difference, rational, we've added an affirmative difference, right? So rational gives you more information than animal. And it's like something more, in a certain sense, than animal. The problem is that with God, we never have an affirmative difference that we can add, that we understand. And that's exactly what Aquinas goes on to say. So he's just said, I've lost my place here. In this way, a complete knowledge of a substance is built up. Then he goes on. However, since in the consideration of the divine substance, we cannot grasp the what as a genus, so what God is, we don't actually know that positively. And since we also cannot derive the distinction of God from things by positive differences, we are obliged to grasp it through negative differences. So, we can add a positive difference to animal, but we can't add a positive difference with respect to God. So what we have to use are negative differences. We have to negate dimensions that are creaturely or bespeak some kind of imperfection or being time-bound or something like that. Still, Aquinas says, yet this knowledge will not be perfect since it will not tell us what God is in himself. Okay, we do get some idea of God. It's just not a perfect idea of God. The more we do this way of negation, and with greater refinement, the more we actually do approach what God is, even though we will never be able to state it positively. We will never actually grasp it in a positive way. So we don't ever get, by natural reason, a positive knowledge of God, but we do get true knowledge of the divine substance in the sense that we know God as distinct from everything else. So here, we've kind of reached the limit of the analogy of the game that you're playing with a friend. Like, when you play that game with a friend, you know what a person is. When you say, is it a person? And they say, you know, no. Suppose we want to say, well, everything is divided into persons, places, or things, something like that. Just so grant me that for a moment. And you say, is it a thing? No. Is it a place? No. Then you say, I know it's a person. We already know what a person is. The problem is that with God, when the subject is God, we don't actually know what he is in a positive way. So the game cannot give us the same kind of knowledge in the case of God. I can affirm his existence in a positive judgment, but I cannot form an idea of that existence for myself. I cannot get a concept of God in his proper mystery. So it means that we do know God in this way, but we know him as unknown. Okay, so that's kind of mysterious, but it's also beautiful. There's a kind of spiritual asceticism here, because the danger is that we will create images of God, even in our philosophizing, that become, as it were, idols. And if they are positive images that we have generated, they will never actually be adequate to him. So this is a kind of real spiritual and intellectual asceticism, to recognize that we must be humble before the mystery of the transcendent God, even in the domain of what reason can know. It's not like a theological humility. It's like an acknowledgement of our real position. So we cannot be happy with our own ideas, in other words, but should find our rest only in the real God who is always going to be beyond what we are able to conceive. Okay. This brings us to the threshold of the need for a higher light. And this is the light of grace, as you saw from that handout yesterday. Now, as I wanted to point out and didn't do probably as good a job in my last lecture about this, there is a light of grace and a light of glory, but the two wisdoms that I'm now talking about, which can be called theological wisdom, and then some would call it mystical wisdom or the gift of the Holy Spirit of wisdom, these two wisdoms are both contained in the light of grace. Okay, so we don't have access in this life to the light of glory. That will be reserved for the beatific vision. So there are three lights: the light of reason, the light of grace, and the light of glory. But the second one is subdivided and generates two kinds of wisdom: theological wisdom and the gift of wisdom, which is a higher way of knowing even than theology knows. But both of these wisdoms are extremely powerful and important for our lives, and there's a real possibility of the human person to rise up to God by way of these higher wisdoms. So philosophy, very important and indispensable, in fact, in coming to know God. But these ways are even better ways. So take a look at the next text on the handout from Summa Theologiae, Prima Pars, Question 1, Article 1. This is, you know, right at the very beginning of the Summa, the very first thing that Aquinas takes up. And the question is whether besides philosophy, whether besides the kind of knowledge of God that we've just been talking about, even by the way of removal, or the negative way, any further teaching is required. And Aquinas' answer is yes. I answer that it was necessary for man's salvation that there should be a knowledge revealed by God besides philosophical science built up by human reason. Firstly, indeed, because man is directed to God as to an end that surpasses the grasp of his reason. And he quotes Isaiah. But the end must first be known by men who are to direct their thoughts and actions to the end. Hence it was necessary for the salvation of man that certain truths which exceed human reason should be made known to him by divine revelation. Okay, this is a very profound point, and I want to start off by just calling your attention to the significance of Aquinas putting this at the very beginning of the Summa. He is not relativizing the importance of philosophy, obviously not. Much of the first part of the Summa is profoundly rich in this philosophical wisdom. But he's situating it in the return of the human creature to God. And this is, in fact, our true ultimate destiny. But we need to know where we are going. Now, on this point, an enormous confusion has arisen in the 20th century. And there's been a very, very vigorous debate that in certain quarters is still going on. And I don't want to get into all of the details of that debate, but just to flag for you that I think this text is already evidence of the way out of the puzzle that some have found themselves in about the relationship between nature and grace, or whether there's a natural desire sown into every human person by nature for the beatific vision. So an example might help us to clarify this question. It's comprehensible for us, you know, in a kind of sci-fi kind of way, to say, you know, I would really like to go to the sun, you know, the center of our solar system, the star at the center of our solar. I'd really like to go there and see what it's like up close. In fact, I would like to go to the center of the sun, right? You can imagine there being some kind of sci-fi novel about there's some kind of wormhole in the space-time continuum, and you're able to teleport to the center of the sun, and what you discover is there's another civilization there, and it's very interesting, and maybe people walk upside down or something. I don't know. Who knows? You know, it could be very weird. But you can imagine that, and you can imagine a person saying, wow, that is really cool. I would really like to do that. Would any sane person actually attempt to really organize his or her life around a project like that? The answer is no, right? And even if you could imagine desiring it, or even if you do in a certain sense desire it, you would not try to build a spacecraft to go to the center of the sun. Okay, first of all, enormously expensive. But beyond that, right, there's all kind. You can start listing the there's probably some science-oriented people here who could list better objections than I can come up with. Right? So what would be the problems if you tried to send a craft to the center of the sun? There's like heat. There's heat. There's radiation. There's, you know, cosmic rays. There's the pressure. I mean, it's...
Okay. There you go.
So... I had not thought of that, but now maybe we should, you know, let's get the funds, let's start doing the crowdsource fundraising, you know. What's that called? GoFundMe? Okay, so you can, it's just not going to be possible for a human being to be at the center of the sun. It's just not possible. And so when you know it's impossible, in a degree of impossibility that just makes it absurd when you begin to think about it, you can have a kind of sci-fi wish for it. But you would not actually, if you're sane, I mean, and most people are sane enough, you would not actually begin to construct your life around it. And if someone was constructing his or her life around it, you would say, you're a crazy person. Now, there are occasionally crazy people who think that they're living in the Middle Ages or something like that, right? You know, they get so into that that they try to kind of structure their life around it. But probably on some level they are aware that it's not really possible for them to live as a medieval, Irish duke or something, right? You know. Okay. This is the kind of thing that Aquinas thinks is the case with our union with God. It is that radically impossible for our nature. We are not capable of being sharers in the divine nature. So when you have worked a little bit with the way of negation, and you have purified some of your ideas about God in this way, you begin to see that the idea that we would have friendship with God in eternity, that we would see him as he is, that we would be with him, that we would share his nature, that's crazy in a certain sense from the perspective of our nature. I mean, it's not insane, but it is just completely beyond what our nature is capable of. And so, given that, if all you have are your natural resources, no one would build a life project around it. Which is why God had to reveal it to us. He had to reveal to us that actually communion with him is possible. Now, of course, some of you certainly know very well that Aristotle thought that communion with the gods was not possible. And it just, he would say, you're confused. Because the gods are so far above us, there's no way you're going to be able to have friendship with them. And on the natural level, he's right about that, I think. It's not possible for us, naturally speaking, to have that kind of relationship with God. However, our nature has a kind of openness upwards that it can be supernaturally elevated by God so as to be capable of this. So this is actually what we are talking about now when we're talking about the mystical or the supernatural gift of grace. So by grace, God is actually able to raise you up, even in the order of knowing, so that you no longer simply know God as the cause of all or by the way of negation, but you begin actually to know by faith who he really is. So we have the technical term for this that Thomas have coined is an obediential potency. Our nature has an obediential potency. That simply means it's a kind of passive potency that needs to be activated. We have all kinds of active potencies. Dr. Fazer made this distinction about God yesterday between active and passive potencies. This is a kind of a radical passive potency in us that we are not able to activate our supernatural life. But we are made as the kind of creatures who can be activated by God to a supernatural life in a way that other animals are not capable of. And why is that? Because we are endowed with an intellect and a will, a spiritual nature. So we have a spiritual dimension to our human nature, which is actually able now, when elevated by God, to know him and love him. So it's an aspect of our being made in the image and likeness of God. And in fact, our salvation depends on this elevation. So there is the need for some further teaching beyond philosophy if we're going to have the salvation that Christians profess to be offered to us, which is friendship with God, communion with him, sharing in his divine nature, as Scripture says in 2 Peter. That we would become sharers in the divine nature. So theology then involves the gift of a higher light to our minds that elevates us into, as it were, a supernatural realm. It like puts us in orbit, no longer simply on the face of the earth, in a higher mode, or there's something now supernatural about the Christian's existence. But before I speak about this supernatural light and precisely the way it's supernatural, I'd like to say something about theology as a science. So we've been talking about the different sciences, the different disciplines, right? And scientia is a kind of certain knowledge. So now I haven't given you the text, but very soon after the text that we just read, here in the first question of the Summa, Aquinas asks, is theology, or sacred doctrine, actually is the word that he uses, is sacred doctrine, holy teaching, is it a science? And he's using that in a technical term, in a technical sense, as a kind of legitimate discipline. It's also asking, does it deserve to be in the university? Because if it's not a science, then maybe it doesn't belong in the university. But if it is a science, then the university should treat it, because we're treating of, we're trying to come to know what is, and in fact, we're trying to come to wisdom. So Aquinas explains that theology is a science because it does give us a certain knowledge of the truth, but it works differently than other sciences. Why? Other sciences are based on the light of reason. That means that they are able to see the why it's true, or they're able to see into the truth of what they are teaching or what they're investigating. So the certitude of their knowledge comes in a certain way from sight, from like direct contact with the reality, or at least from a logically valid syllogism, right? So you will have conclusive knowledge. But theology does not work this way, because we do not have sight, right? I've just been talking about how we do not know what God is. Our minds are not able, by the power of natural light of reason, to see him. Therefore, theology depends on faith. So faith is the foundation for theology. Now, this is actually also in the contemporary, even Catholic, some Catholic universities, is a very controversial thing to say, because it's saying that in order to do theology, in order to be a professor of theology, you must profess the faith. That is the starting point, right? It's therefore a very different kind of activity from religious studies. Okay, religious studies does what? It studies the kind of human phenomena of religiosity, or it studies systems of beliefs, you know, various systems of belief, what certain one religion or another religion holds to be the case, or holds to be true about God, or the way they think about the relation of man in relation to the divine, or something like that. Okay, that is a legitimate discipline. But it is not, properly speaking, theology, according to Aquinas. Because theology is a source of wisdom that operates according to a higher light that allows us to know God himself. So not just to know things that religions believe about God. That's not what we're studying in theology. What we're studying is God. And we cannot see God by the light of our minds. So we are studying God as he reveals himself to us. So faith depends on the knowledge of someone else who speaks, like a witness who testifies to us about the truth. Now, it's reasonable for us to believe witnesses, and we talked about this with Father James Brent yesterday. So it's analogous, there's an analogy, it's similar to, although not absolutely identical to, for some reasons that we can talk about, but the knowledge by faith is similar to the way we depend on others to know things like the place of our birth or who our father is, or for that matter, that your mother loves you, right? You actually can't see that directly. You have to believe her when she tells you that she loves you. I mean, maybe it's been an elaborate ruse all these years. You know, I hope not about my mother, you know, but anyway, whether you like this talk right now. Like, I actually can't know that directly. It's very common for priests to deliver a homily, and afterwards, you know, the people walking out say, "Hey, nice homily, Father, you know, thank you." And it's like, I don't think they all mean that. You know, I'm not sure they all mean that. I can't actually know directly. I can only know what they tell me, and I can sort of infer from maybe their behaviors. But, okay, so we depend all the time, and some very, very important things depend on believing another person. And so it's actually quite reasonable. It would be very unreasonable. Aquinas actually says, stultum est, foolish. It would be foolish to not do this. Theology works in this way, which is why Aquinas and the Thomists have called it a subalternated science. That means it's a science that is depending on some other knowledge. In this case, whose knowledge is theology depending on? God's knowledge, first of all, God's knowledge of himself, and the knowledge of the blessed who see God by beatific vision. So Aquinas says, theology is a science that depends on the science of God, namely the certain knowledge that God has of himself, and the science, the certain knowledge that the blessed have insofar as they see. So our destiny in the light of glory is to have that very science in plenitude, but we have it in a different way in this life by faith, which gives us real knowledge of the object, right? We are actually knowing it, but we're knowing it not as seeing it, but as learning about it from another or based on the testimony of another. Now, there's another important element to add here. How is this not like believing your mother when she tells you where you were born? There's something more happening in supernatural faith. It involves a gift to the mind of a greater participation in God's light. So this is from that text that we saw last time, that there is actually a light of grace that is being given to the mind, which endows it with a different sort of act than the natural act of believing. It makes it a supernatural act. It gives it a kind of supernatural firmness or certitude. And it puts you in real contact with a supernatural object, which is God himself. So because of the height of the object that we are trying to know, we need to be raised up to it. And the light of faith is a supernatural light given to the mind that puts our minds in contact in a certain way with that object, which is God, a way that is supernatural because God is so far above us. So specifically, the light of faith, Aquinas would say, is the supernatural illumination by which a believer gives an unqualified and unconditional assent to what has been proposed to him for belief. So you don't actually see the truth of it, but by the light of faith, you are able to assent to it without any reservation, without any qualification, and with a kind of supernatural certitude. So in Aquinas' view, this gives us a kind of what the later tradition will call a per se or substantially supernatural act, as opposed to a per accidens or modally supernatural act. What's the difference? In a per accidens supernatural act, it's an act that you could have performed because of your nature, but it just so happens that in this case God helped you do it. So you could think of like the virtue of courage, right? You are naturally able to make certain courageous acts, but on a particular occasion God might move you to be courageous, say in the defense of the faith. Okay, and you would say, oh, whoa, there, that act of courage was supernatural. How is it supernatural? Not because what you did was supernatural in itself, but because the way you were moved to do it was supernatural. Okay, this is something that is modally supernatural or per action and supernatural. You could, in theory, have done the same thing by your own natural powers, but it just so happens that in this case, God helped you do it, or he infused that act of courage into you, or a virtue of courage. But with faith, we're talking about something that's supernatural in a different way, a qualitatively different way. It's not just like believing your mother. Because what you are doing is your mind is being put into contact with God himself, is being put into relationship with God, so that you begin to know God in a certain way, how he knows himself, by a kind of participation in his own self-knowledge. And this is like being boosted up into orbit, as it were. Human beings are not normally supposed to live in space, but we can get there if you have a strong enough booster. Okay, so here, maybe an analogy, another analogy might be helpful. The difference between knowing facts about someone and knowing someone. So I have to push myself in terms of popular culture here So my example is going to be rather dated, but you know Kevin Bacon, right? Kevin Bacon, actor in many, many films. Have you ever played the Kevin Bacon game? You've heard of this game. If you have, that's another parlor game that you can play tonight, if you want to. Kevin Bacon has been married, I was happy to discover, to Kira Sedgwick for like 27 years. Okay, they've only ever been married once. That's pretty good for a Hollywood actor. But you could imagine someone being like the number one fan of Kevin Bacon. And the number one fan might know a whole lot of weird details about Kevin Bacon. Might know, in fact, everything that you can discover on the internet about Kevin Bacon, which is probably a lot. Might know like things like what was his favorite color when he was in kindergarten, you know? That kind of stuff shows up on the internet about certain people. And it's if someone becomes a fan to that degree, it's a little weird. It's even more weird if that fan begins showing up outside of his house, right? And trying to get into his house because she says, I'm the best friend of Kevin Bacon because I know all these things about Kevin Bacon. Kira Sedgwick may not know what his favorite color was when he was in kindergarten, but she knows him better than the number one fan because she actually knows him. There's a different kind of knowledge that you have when you know a person in a kind of personal relationship where there is an exchange, a personal exchange between you and a personal communion between you. And it's very different from just having facts about the person. So no amount of facts about a person adds up to knowing the person in the same sense. Okay, this is what Aquinas thinks is happening in the virtue of faith. The virtue of faith gives you to know God, not to just know about God. It's true that we express the faith in propositions. And so we write a creed, right? And you affirm all the propositions in the creed. But when you affirm those propositions, you are not just affirming propositions. You are affirming the propositions because you know God. And this also helps illuminate the traditional Catholic teaching about the sensus fidelium, which is that sometimes there can be a proposition about God that someone will announce to you, and the faithful will react by going, I don't think so. I don't think that's right. Okay. Even if the magisterium has not defined, that's an error, the faithful may have a sense that somehow this is not who they know. That's because of the supernatural virtue of faith, which gives you to know God directly. And it comes with an additional gift, the gift of supernatural charity in the normal case. So now, yes, it's possible to receive faith without charity. We call that dead faith. And that's the kind of faith that someone who is baptized but commits mortal sin, that's the kind of faith that you have. You believe, but you're not in a living relationship of friendship with God because you've preferred something else. But normally, the gift of faith comes with the gift of charity, and it is kind of ordered to erupting into charity. Aquinas has a very beautiful way of talking about this. He actually uses this strange Latin word called prorumpere, this verb. When you receive the grace of faith, you prorumpere into love, which is you sort of erupt into love. Maybe the best analogy for this, I'm saying this in kind of a facetious way. If you live in Switzerland, as I did for a number of years, you know that the cows in the summer live high up on the mountain pasture, but in the winter they bring them down into the valley onto the farm and they spend the whole winter in a barn. So you can imagine they're like anxious to get out at the end when the snow finally melts. So there's like, you can watch videos of this on YouTube, the Swiss letting the cows out of the barn, and the cows run out and they begin jumping around. Like you've never seen cows jumping, but actually it's quite extraordinary, and they are rejoicing, you know, they're like erupting. This is what Aquinas thinks is happening. It's even more than this. You erupt into love. Why? Because you know God now in a supernatural way. The goodness of God, the perfection of God, you have real contact with God. You melt into love, you begin to know God as he really is, and therefore you begin to love him above all things. And that is the root of this higher wisdom, which we call theology. Now, theology is, properly speaking, a science because it takes this gift of faith and it then puts it as the starting point for all of the power that our minds are endowed with. Okay, so theology is not just the act of faith, but the act of faith is the foundation for theology. As theology then begins to reflect with the power of our minds on what we know by faith. So it can be actually a very rigorous exercise, like I was talking about in the homily today. Trinitarian theology is a real exercise of the mind. It calls for rigor. You have to work, you know, you actually have to really work with your mind. But it starts from the starting point of what God has revealed to us about himself, and it generates a real wisdom. It's a theological wisdom because it gives us now some access to the truth of who God really is in person. And this actually is the way of salvation. So not every Christian needs to be a theologian. Every Christian needs to have the virtue of faith, enlivened by charity, which gives him or her real friendship with God and contact with God. But the theologian has the great privilege of going deeper into that knowledge. Because as you study it, you come to know more fully what it means. So when you, for example, profess in the creed that the Son is consubstantial with the Father. Okay, we all say that every Sunday if you're a Catholic and you go to Mass. What does that mean? I mean, for most of us, it's certainly growing up, you know, you just say the words and you kind of have some vague idea that it means something important, but you don't really know what it means. You're not ready to negate. You're not ready to negate it. You wouldn't contradict it. But if someone asked you to explain it, you couldn't go very far. That means that your faith is in some measure still implicit. And you need to work to discover the meaning of that proposition of faith. And as you discover the meaning that the Son is consubstantial with the Father, of the same substance, then you begin to enter into the truth of the unity of the divine persons. And the more deeply you go into that, the more, I mean, it's wonderful. Now, you can do that as a kind of pure academic exercise, in which case it can be very dry. But if you do it as a living exercise, where you're explicating or you're exploring the truth of what you believe and, of the life of God, then there's a tremendous wisdom that is born of this, which is the second wisdom, the theological wisdom. Okay, we're sort of running out of time. I don't want to go on too much longer so as to have time for questions. But I now want to talk about the gift of wisdom. So this is an additional gift which perfects the gift of faith. In fact, the gifts of the Holy Spirit, this is a very interesting, and there's actually a lot of contemporary interest in the gifts of the Holy Spirit in Aquinas. And great room for doctoral research if there are some budding theologians. When Aquinas talks about the gifts of the Holy Spirit, of course, where do we find these? We find them in Isaiah 11:2, enumerated really about the Messiah. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the Spirit of piety, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. So from that you get seven gifts of the Holy Spirit: wisdom, understanding, counsel, knowledge, fortitude, piety, and fear of the Lord. So there's a long patristic tradition about trying to distinguish the gifts from each other, and also distinguishing the gifts from the virtues, like the virtue of faith. For Aquinas makes a major step forward in the theological tradition, and it really becomes kind of the standard way then, after Aquinas, to talk about the gifts, that he sees the gifts as an inspiration. That's actually the original spiritual, or the original scriptural word there, right? The Spirit of wisdom, the Spirit of understanding, the Spirit of counsel. And Aquinas says, well, that scriptural language should teach us something about the gifts of the Holy Spirit. They are a kind of inspiration or a movement that comes from God. that moves us in a higher way than our minds are capable of directing. So it's a kind of disposition to be moved directly by God, according to some higher reason. And that's why, then, we can see how this, the highest wisdom available to us in this life, is in a certain way even above the gift of faith. In what sense? The gift of faith is stably given to us as a theological virtue. A virtue is something we really possess. It's really an accidental quality of soul, right? It's a habitus. So, in the gift of faith, we receive the light habitually in the mind, which supernaturally makes possible our knowledge of God in the supernatural mode. So the virtues, like the virtue of faith, is in a certain way in our hands, right? You can use a virtue. It can be habitual or it can be actual. By the way, just by way of footnote, you should try to make it actual more often than you do, probably. That's the name of the game in the Christian life. What you want is not to just be habitually believing God, but to actually believe Him. And not just to be habitually loving Him, but to actually do so. And the more you do that actually, the more holy you will be. And in fact, this is going to be nothing else than the activity of heaven, knowing and loving God in perfect actuality. So go more from potency to act, if you want a little metaphysical encouragement here. You know, potency to act with respect to faith or charity. We, in a way, can initiate that because of the way the virtues are possessed by us. But we cannot do so with the gifts. The gifts are habitual dispositions given in the gift of grace. So if you're in a state of sanctifying grace, you have the gifts of the Holy Spirit habitually. But you cannot activate them on your own. They must be activated, as it were, from above, as God moves you according to a higher wisdom, a higher reason. So this is what Aquinas thinks is happening in the gift of understanding and in the gift of wisdom. God is giving to us a new movement towards our ultimate end, which our minds are not even themselves capable of fully grasping. So we are being ordered to God according to a plan that transcends our vision or our understanding. Which means sometimes we will be moved to do things that we do not fully appreciate the significance of. And this, I think, coheres very well with the church's spiritual tradition of, you know, people who have very powerful mystical experiences. But do not think that that's all that I am speaking about here. Because you have these gifts. And you should ask and open yourself to be moved by them more and more. As you open yourself to this kind of movement by the Holy Spirit, it's actually possible for you now to in a certain way, obtain a wisdom that your mind is not even capable of fully comprehending. As God draws you into His wisdom. So there remains something obscure about this, and, you know, mysterious. We can't simply make it happen, and we don't simply understand what it means, but it is a wonderful elevation of the human person, and Aquinas understands it precisely as we are put on the trajectory back to God, as our minds rise back up to God. So I will stop there, and we can have some questions.
Okay, yeah, so I want to go back to your son analogy, because that kind of intrigued me a little bit. So I want to give you, like, a counter analogy, and then I want to ask you, like, whether or not this person is sane in this situation. So suppose that instead, like, suppose I'm, like, a really bad person with, like, billions of dollars, and I abduct a whole bunch of children, and they don't know that they've been abducted because they were abducted as infants, and I raise them in a secluded environment, and I teach them about, like, rocket science and all the engineering knowledge that they would need to build a rocket and fly a rocket, that kind of thing. but I teach them a very specific kind of astronomy that, or system of astronomy that I basically just totally make up, but I make it sound consistent enough that it sounds as though it's believable, and it basically is the system in the
right.
sci-fi book. And eventually one of those kids is inspired, or after they grow up, after they're educated, they're inspired to build their rocket ship and fly to the center of the sun. Now, I would see that as, well, this person may not be insane, they're lacking key pieces of information, and they were put in a situation that would never allow them to question the information they were given. So, would you qualify that kid as insane, or would you just qualify that kid as misinformed?
Yeah, I think that's misinformation.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, what I was trying to illustrate with that example is that you don't try to do what you know is impossible.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So, if you know it's impossible, you're not even going to try to do it. And we can think of that in trivial ways, like, well, it's impossible for me to be in Los Angeles tonight, so, like, I got a dinner invitation, but I'm obviously not going to accept it, you know,
okay.
because I just can't get there. But even more fundamentally, like, it would be weird to, like, if you, I mean, what I was trying to do is construct an example where it's a project that would be a major feature of your life.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And obviously, you're not going to do that. Even, you know, I might say, well, maybe if I run to the airport right now, I could catch a flight or something, you know, with Los Angeles. But, like, there's just no way I'm going to go to the sun. I'm not even going to get to the moon, you know. So that's a great tragedy in my life. But, yeah.
Some clarification. So you're saying it was impossible, like, what was not impossible for previous philosophers or people who were trying to, like, pursue God in some way, to have hoped that there might be some way of reaching God that they didn't know at that time, or that God, or the hope, or maybe come up with the idea, even if it seemed far-fetched, then that God might actually reach out to them. And wasn't it, weren't there some philosophical movements that did entail, like, certain practices to attempt to, like, commune with the divine previous to Christianity?
Yeah, okay, well, there, I think we should make some distinctions. I think maybe I would say two things. One, now I've just forgotten what one of them was, so maybe I'll start with the other one. We can, you know, you can talk about other religions and say, well, doesn't Buddhism aim at this, or does Hinduism aim at this, and so forth? There's actually a very good book by Augustine de Noia, who is a Dominican from our province, taught for many years here, and is now the adjunct secretary of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, so he's an archbishop in Rome. Although, in fact, he's physically here today, so you might be able to meet him. Anyway, he wrote a very interesting book about the diversity of religions, where he said, his argument is basically this: be careful about assuming that all of the religions are aiming at the same thing. Like, you often hear this, like, oh, they're just different paths up the same mountain, and they're trying to get to the same summit. He said that's actually a kind of, well, he put it much more politely than this. I'm going to kind of make it brutally direct. You know, it's like, that's kind of paternalistic from the Christian perspective vis-a-vis these other religions. That is, we assume that they are seeking communion with the triune God, and they just don't fully understand it or fully know it, but that's really what their system is about. But if you begin paying attention to what other religions say, do they actually say that? I mean, usually it's Christians who are assuming that that's what other religions are saying, or people who are post-Christian, you know, but coming from a kind of Christian background. I mean, at least a cultural milieu where they're familiar with the kinds of things that Christianity claims, even if they're not Christians themselves. So they are assuming that that's true about other religions. But if you actually look at what the other religions say, what do they say? Well, here Augustine de Noia goes through this, you know, kind of phenomenology of religion. Religion proposes, like every religion proposes, some kind of all-encompassing aim for your life, and then a set of doctrines which especially teach you how to attain that aim. So they inculcate a kind of way of life that's ordered, that's intrinsically related to the aim. Just like if you want to be a great cello player, there's certain things you will need to do in your life in order to attain that aim. And it's not arbitrary what those things are. There's actually, like, very good reason why you have to hold your hand this way and you have to practice a lot. And, okay. So the way of life is intrinsically ordered to the objective or the aim, so we should look at what they propose. And in fact, what they propose are very different aims and very different patterns of life. So in Buddhism, which doesn't even clearly, depending on the version, doesn't clearly claim to be a revelation, the aim is not communion with a personal God, nor is it perdurance of my person, but actually the recognition that this is all an illusion and I need to cease being a person. And this actually is not at all like what Christians think we are doing. Like, it's quite the opposite in a certain sense. Christians want to say that the ultimate aim is to be more fully a person and to know divine persons and to have a personal communion with them. Likewise with Islam, for example. You could take Islam. We could go through other religions too, but in Islam, there is a specific negation that we can have communion with God. So God remains utterly transcendent. What is the ultimate aim? It's a kind of paradise, which is a quasi, you know, it's like earthly delights. It's a garden of delights where there will be sensible delights, but not the kind of mystical vision of the divine essence, you know. That's absolutely excluded on principle. So do not assume, then, that all the religions are aiming at the same thing. Now, I think I've forgotten your question.
Is it not possible to conceive
of... Oh, is it not...
Hope
yeah, okay, so is it...
Naturally,
yeah, is it possible to conceive? I think that... So maybe this is the second thing that I'm saying. We are coming at this question from a profound familiarity with Christianity and what it promises. So it seems kind of obvious to us that heaven should be possible. But even there, if you begin to talk with Christians who have not really reflected on this or not been well catechized about what heaven is, they will often give you something much more like the Garden of Delights and not really understand that what we're talking about is communion with God in the way that we've been talking about it today. And that's precisely what we need to like clarify. And do they really think that that is possible? Well, I mean, Aquinas thinks that it is not something that you would desire, that desire has to be elicited from you. Now, further nuance, he would say it is possible that God does this to people outside of the dispensation of Christianity. So it may be that, in fact, other people who are not Christian or people who lived long before Christianity or even before, you know, Moses or before Abraham, that these people were given a kind of gift to desire this. But if they received it, it was a desire that was already supernatural, that was activated by God's supernatural gift and not from their nature. I think that's the key.
So it's possible to have the idea without grace, but it's not possible to hope to reach it.
It's possible to have the idea in a kind of science fiction way, as I've been describing it. Yeah, that's what I would contend. I think that's what Aquinas would contend. Yeah?
So I'm wondering about these things that are knowable by natural reason but also are revealed. So let's say you take, like, I think this might complicate things when it comes to, like, the political sphere. So say you have a picture of the political sphere where it's like, well, everything that's accessible to natural reason is part of public reason, and so that's what you base, like, your politics on or something. But then there are these things that are both accessible to natural reason, but you know, you could make some errors, like Aquinas says, that's why it needs to be revealed, is because, you know, it's more difficult to reason to it. So it's also part of revelation. So an example might be, you know, and this might be a mystery of the situation, but let's say you think that, like, abortion, maybe you're like, yeah, like, if you argue about personal identity, you can come to a view where a person that starts at conception. But also there's this additional fact about revelation where, you know, there's a soul granted, you know, to each human at conception, right? And so it's like, you know, this additional fact through revelation that makes you even more certain about the conclusions of natural reason. And so then it seems like, well, like, you're really sure about, like, what you should say about abortion. But, like, when it just comes to public reason, like, there might not be as much certainty there. And so I was wondering if that creates a conflict.
Yeah, well, you know, the point that you're making is the latter part of the article from question one, article one, the bottom of the handout. That's precisely what Aquinas goes on to say, which I didn't read out, which is that it can be difficult to know specifically about God, even the things that natural reason can know. And therefore, it was fitting for God to reveal them to us because it makes it more certain and easier for us to come to know them. And I think it's likewise true about other truths, like conclusions of the natural law. The first principles of the natural law are self-evident, and the first set of conclusions are known by almost everybody. But the more precise you try to make the conclusions, the further away from the general principles you get and to particulars, the more difficult it is to see that clearly, and the more disagreement you're likely to have. So there's both more difficulty in arriving at, there's more uncertitude about how true it is, and then there's going to be more disagreement. So I think there, but sometimes it is revealed. Some of those things can be revealed, in which case, then you know it with a different sort of certitude. I'm not sure that I've really answered your question, just to elaborate, that I think that it is an aspect of the way the faith operates.
Yeah, I mean, could I follow up or move on? I mean, so my thought was, like, this might be an argument that even if you're certain that horse is drawn because of this natural reason combined with revelation, then maybe you should still be more permissive about it when it comes to the political sphere because, like, people don't have this sort of certainty that comes from revelation.
Yeah, I mean, I would respond to that by saying I don't think abortion is one of these difficult cases. Because the direct killing of the innocent is very close to the most evident natural law principles, you know. So that's not a hard one. Where it can be hard for other reasons, you know, because there are we see the difficult position that this woman is in, and why she might want to find some other way out of her difficulty. But in fact, that can never justify the direct killing of an innocent human being, even if it makes it a more, in a certain way, comprehensible choice, or even if we would say, well, this person was under incredible pressure, and in fact, often, as many of you know, that is often the case, that women who have abortions will say that they felt that they had no choice. I mean, it's not something that empowers them to have a choice, but in fact, even the possibility of having an abortion means that some of them will feel that they have no choice but to do it when they find themselves pregnant and the boyfriend says, well, listen, I'm driving you to to get the abortion. So she feels like she's got no way out. You know, her family's not going to support her. He's not going to be in the picture. She just feels totally trapped, and this seems like the only way out, even though she's very unhappy about it. So we could say, okay, I understand in a certain way there's lots of mitigating circumstances and her culpability may be very reduced, or even not there at all. But I don't think it's a hard question to say the act is wrong, or the directly killing the innocent is always wrong. Anyway, yeah. Yes?
So I was just kind of picking up on the earlier questions, which is that you're talking about whether or not there are other traditions that have this conception of like a personal relationship with God. First thing that came to my mind is Neoplatonism. I'm not an expert in Neoplatonism, but it just seems to me like, there's a reason why Augustine said they had this idea that they were somehow closest to truth, right? Which is that they have this idea that the end of ethics, the end of life, is theosis, which is a kind of immediate mystical union with the one, right? God.
I think Aquinas would say if they really had that idea, it would be by grace, but not by nature. But of course, I mean, in other words, we can find that kind of grace being given outside of the Christian dispensation. But nature itself would not conclude that it could have a participation with God.
Right. So what are the advantages of saying that versus just saying that they were confused about what was possible because they had some bad philosophical concepts?
Yeah, well, it could be that they were confused by what is... That could also be, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to over, like, I hit this point too hard, and I don't want it to distract from the bigger, the reason for making this point, is just to point out that what Aquinas thinks that what faith is giving you is radically different from what, like, it's really elevating you to a new zone. And that is something that has largely been lost from view, even among Catholics. And there's reasons for that, which I could talk about. For example, Duns Scotus, the Franciscan theologian who comes, you know, a generation after Aquinas, or more than a generation, he says that the act of faith, he does not really accept that there is a light of faith. And he thinks that faith is simply what I called modally supernatural. God moves you to it, or actually the way he describes it is faith requires that God says something, so you believe God, but it's exactly the same kind of act as believing your mother, and there's no difference between it. So, I mean, that's a typical move for Scotus, to kind of flatten everything out and make it, like, there's no analogy in the act. It's a kind of univocal predication. And he's doing that because he thinks that that's important for, you know, for theology to be a science. But it has the very negative consequence that you end up thinking that really, in faith, God is just saying something to us and then we move ourselves to believe it according to our natural light. And it doesn't really then involve any kind of supernatural elevation of the person. And so then what is the object of faith? You get theologians saying the object of faith is just the propositions. And what happens when you go too far down that road? You end up saying, well, actually, faith does not give us to know God. It just gives us to know things about God. And then it's like we get stranded on Earth, like when we really want to be on our way to the sun. So Aquinas really thinks that the life of heaven has begun in you by the gift of faith and charity. I didn't really talk about this, but let me just throw it out there in a completely insufficient way, just to pique your interest. Aquinas thinks that the divine persons dwell in you precisely according to the gift of faith and the gift of charity. So just as the eternal Son proceeds as word, so he impresses the pattern of his procession by way of intellect on your soul when you receive the gift of faith, so that he is really there in person according to faith. And the Holy Spirit impresses the pattern of his procession, the mode of his procession by way of love, on you when you receive the gift of charity. And where the Father, or where the Son and the Holy Spirit have been sent, the Father also is. So all three divine persons dwell in you in person, precisely according to these gifts of faith and charity. And that's enormously important for the Christian life. It means that this theological mode of this second wisdom, or the light of grace, is already giving you a share in the divine life and making the persons dwell in you. So, I mean, the spiritual consequences of that are enormous. So when you make that other move, you lose all of that. On faith? I have an article that I could send to you, yeah. It hasn't been published yet, but I'm hoping that it will be soon. So, yeah. Yes. Father Gregory, you...
I was just going to say maybe one more question, and then we can take a break and go to the little session.
Right.
Could you kind of comment and clarify the relationship of this light of grace with nature and the whole... I think you mentioned it before, and something like nature...
Nature-grace debate, or...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay, so the light, what is the light of faith compared to the light of reason? Aquinas actually, this goes back to the text that we saw yesterday. Aquinas thinks that there is a hierarchy of lights. And the divine light, you know, is the true light, and every other light is a participation in that divine light. So the light of reason is the lowest intellectual light. Now, there's like the physical light of the sun that gives sense knowledge even to animals, but that's of a different analogical, you know, level. So when we're talking about an intellectual light, The lowest level is the light of reason, by which we're able to abstract what is intelligible from what we sense. But the light of faith is a higher participation in the light of God. We receive it according to a certain obscurity, because our minds are made to grasp reality from senses. And it's not giving us a light to extract what is intelligible from what we sense. Instead, what is it giving us to do? It's giving us to hear a message revealed by God and to recognize in it the truth, and therefore to assent without qualification to the truth. And why are we able to do that? Because actually we have some obscure but real knowledge of the person of God, or of the divine persons. I mean, in other words, we really know him in the way that Kevin Bacon knows his wife Kira Sedgwick, and how she knows him, like a personal relationship, which allows you to judge, you know, like, oh, that's just not something Kevin Bacon would do, you know? And it's something like that that allows you, and that's obviously a very low analogy, but it's something like that that the light of faith enables you to do. So the light of faith is really strengthening your intellect to operate in a higher mode, but because our nature is lower, it is very obscure to us. So when we get to heaven, it will not seem so difficult, but it is difficult for us now because we are the kinds of creatures who know through senses. This is not our knowledge through senses. So it's we really have to like rise up, and our minds will remain somewhat dissatisfied because they're not seeing. Have I answered your question? Ah, okay. So this is in a way a separate topic, but it's to say that grace is not just something totally outside of nature. I mean, in fact, the way Aquinas would talk about it is grace doesn't just build on nature the way you have like a ham sandwich, you know, you got the bread and then you got the ham and then you got the lettuce and, you know, like you're just adding a layer that doesn't, but actually grace is working within nature to first to heal it, but then to elevate it and perfect it so that it is able to do something beyond what its natural capacity is. So that's why, as an intellectual creature, our minds have an openness to the realm of the spirit, you might say. I mean, that's to put it in kind of poetic language, what we're talking about when we talk about understanding. We're understanding free from matter, even though we obtain the truth in a certain way through sense knowledge of material things. But we're able somehow to rise above material things to the immaterial. But our minds are sort of in between, or they're constantly going in between. And now what is happening is they're being elevated to a realm that is really above that, and they're not used to that. But it really is an elevation of your mind. It's not just something like layered on top. It's an expansion, or a perfection, a healing, and then an elevation. Is that explaining in some way? Maybe we can talk about this more, because that's a very big and you know, there's a lot more that can be said there. Thank you.